You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond on Radio Reverb and as a podcast which you can download from wherever you get yours. This month, we talk to authors who take three very different periods in history and use them to form their fiction. Brighton-based Alice O'Keefe's new book Skylark explores the controversial spy cop scandal of the 90s. Local writer Nafal Naras' new book Brighton Funk is a coming-of-age story of a mixed-race teenager dealing with the turbulent period of adolescence in Brighton in the 70s. And Melissa Fu, whose novel Peach Blossom Spring is inspired by her own family's history in China from the 1930s to the present day. We also talk to Creative Future about their Writers Awards for underrepresented writers, which are now open for entries. As ever, you can get in touch with us on Instagram at BTM Book Club and email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. If you have a literary event or programme that you want to shout about, get in touch. We would love to support you. Local author and journalist Alice O'Keefe, whose new book Skylark came out last year. Here is the blurb. It's the mid-90s and rebellion is in the air. Skylark is an activist, a raver, a tree dweller, a world changer. Handsome, dependable Dan appears on the scene, offering her the security she has never had. When they fall in love, she shows him a new way to live. He will never be the same. But Dan has a secret which Skylark must never, ever know. A secret so powerful that its fault lines run from their ordinary council flat right up to the highest echelons of the state. Their story is the story of Britain's undercover police. As Skylark comes to doubt not only Dan's commitment to their shared ideals, but his very identity, she finds herself asking, can you ever really know the person you love? Alice O'Keefe, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much, Hannah. It's great to be here.
Can you introduce yourself and your writing background?
Yeah, I started as a journalist. I worked on The Observer. I worked at The New Statesman. I always worked in sort of books and arts journalism. And then after I had my first son, I started writing fiction. And that was sort of when I was about 30. I never really thought I'd write fiction. It was a bit of a surprise. And I found that I needed to, and I really enjoyed it. And I started doing some more personal kind of columns for The New Statesman as well, which were sort of autobiographical, but also semi-fictional. And those columns came together to form my first novel, which was called On the Up. And that came out in 2019. And then I just had this idea for writing about the spy cop story, which some of your listeners might already know about, where undercover police were sent in to spy on activist groups. And they often formed relationships with the women in those groups. And this all started coming out in the news around 2017. And I was just fascinated by it and fascinated by what those relationships must have been like and what that kind of deception must have done to the people who were in those relationships. So I was sort of obsessed with the story and I started writing Skylark. And and now it's come out and it's my second book.
And here we are. So it's a wonderful book. It's really, really engaging and gripping. I couldn't put it down. So you said a bit about why you've decided to explore this period in history, but how did you do it? How did you research it?
Well, some of it was from memory. I was around on the fringes of this scene in the 90s as a young teenager. I wasn't really involved, but I was sort of peeping in through the window and seeing people who were slightly older than me doing all this exciting stuff and putting on raves and protests. And I just thought they were amazing. And I went to quite a few of the parties in the protests. And so some of the scenes in the book are directly from my memories as a young teenager. The research, there's a wonderful book about the spy cops scandal called Undercover by Rob Evans and Paul Lewis. And they interviewed all the women, a lot of the women who went through this. So that was a very important source for this book. And then there were some other books about the 90s that I read. I love Jay Griffiths, is a writer I really admire. And she's her book, An Archipelago was something that really took me to the protest scene, took me into the sort of mentality and the atmosphere of the protest scene as well. So it was a combination of personal experience and reading. And then at a certain point, you just have to put the books down and sort of let your imagination take over.
What was the most surprising thing that you discovered in your research, or the most shocking thing?
Oh, there's just so much about the SpyCop scandal that is completely shocking. I mean, it's not that I didn't know it, but actually reading about women who had babies with undercover policemen while they were in their undercover identity, not knowing, you know, that they would turn out to be people from the other side of the line who were then enmeshed in their lives completely forever and their children, you know, we all know this, but actually try just researching the details and how those men kind of deceived their way into these women's lives and how they became very emotionally attached to the women as well. I mean, I think that was something that surprised me, was just how much of a toll these relationships took on the men. Quite a lot of the men who were sent in as undercover cops ended up having psychological breakdowns because their identities just got so confused. So I guess I went into it very much from a sort of activist point of view, and the research helped me to also see from the police side that it wasn't an easy assignment and it wasn't without cost for them.
Absolutely, because you're not unsympathetic in the writing of this undercover police character in the book. This went on until so recently. It's mad.
It is. It was going on from the 60s up until about 2017. So it was decades. I mean, our country, I think this is something maybe people don't realise, that the policing in our country, protests, the whole of the protest scene has really been controlled and managed through the use of undercover cops. And now they're not able to do that anymore because of this scandal. So that's why we're seeing a lot more of the repressive policing legislation coming out now, because they can't get the information anymore. So they can't control it from the inside. They're now having to find other strategies and other means of controlling it more repressively. So that was another reason why this subject interested me, because I felt like it was a bit of a tipping point in history. You know, in the 90s, we were allowed to protest a lot because the police did have their information. They kind of knew what was going on and they were happy just to let us get on with it to a certain extent. But I'm not quite sure that's going to be the case really now. So yeah, it felt important to kind of put it down in writing.
Absolutely. Alice, please, can you read some from this book?
Sure. I'm going to read a section. It's actually from the middle of the book. So the main character, Skylark, has various moments in which she starts to suspect that something isn't quite right with her relationship and Dan isn't quite who he says he is. And this is a moment when things start to tip for her. Daniel Keller. She turned over the driving license in her hand. It wasn't like she'd searched for it. It was just there in the glove compartment of the van, along with the cracked tape boxes and tissues and tins of barley sugar. It was Dan all right in the photo. Square jaw, dark eyes, gappy front teeth. The face she'd seen when she opened her eyes every morning for the last 4 years. She knew it better than she knew her own. But she didn't know the name. Keller. Daniel Keller. On the other side of the windscreen, it was a dull grey day on the Holloway Road. The Christmas lights were still up, although it was the first week of January. None of those big dramatic maybes had come to pass. The world hadn't ended. The computers were still working. The cogs of global capital were still turning. Cars were still belching petroleum fumes out into the atmosphere. Chainsaws were still buzzing away in the rainforest. The whole rotten system had survived intact as the clock ticked past midnight and a new millennium began. But that name, it set her bones humming. She stuffed the license into her pocket. The world outside retreated into the far distance. The shoppers with their sale bags, two pigeons fighting over a box of fried chicken, the number 30 huffing past the stop. She was in a lonely, faraway place, the icy top of a Himalayan mountain. She put her hand on her balloon-tight tummy and ran it along the right-hand side where she could feel the curve of his spine. 3 weeks until she would meet her baby. "I'll ask your father later," she told him, told her humming bones. So when Dan came out of Mothercare with the buggy in its box, looking all satisfied with his new purchase, when he loaded it into the back and hopped into the driver's side, she didn't say a word. And all the way home, while he chatted about we need to buy peas. And did I tell you on my way this weekend? And remember to call the hospital, won't you? She stayed there on top of her Himalayan mountain and thought, Keller, Keller, Keller. Repeated it in her head until it sounded like a foreign language. They bumped back down Drayton Park, past the Arsenal and down Seven Sisters Road. The whole time one question was turning in her head. Who is Daniel Keller?
Oh, that's such a good and gripping part of the book. Alice, what is your writing process? So I'd love to hear more about your first book, On the Up, and how that came about from your work as a journalist, as you were saying, and doing a bit of writing for New Statesman. And how is the process different from writing articles and personal essays to novel writing?
Yeah, I think it was a big journey for me in the course of writing the first book, because I'd always written factual stuff. And it was very, very difficult for me to get away from reality. I was very reluctant to let go of the real and take that plunge with my imagination, which is why it took me about 6 years to write my first book, because I was gripping so tightly to reality. And eventually I sort of managed to loosen up and let it go. And that's when my first book really took shape. This book was such an enjoyable book to write because I'd done that difficult thing of releasing my anxiety about creating an imaginary world, and I just kind of let myself dive into it. I'd taken up meditation, and I think that really made a difference. It sort of allowed me to access my imaginative world in a way that felt quite different, and allowed me to enter into the experience of other characters who weren't me, which just is such a wonderful thing to do. So I got there in the end.
Absolutely. So Alice, you live in Brighton. How long have you lived here, and is this a good place to be a writer?
For me, it's been a wonderful place to be a writer. I came from London. I left London about 6 or 7 years ago now. And Brighton has allowed me to have a lot more space in my life, both physically, just in terms of being able to go down to the beach and just feel that space. And also just not having to work quite as much as I was working in London. So it's freed me up a lot. And I've just started to get to know some other writers down here as well. It sort of hasn't been something that happened straight away, but it's now starting to feel like there is a bit of a community around, which is really helpful as well. So, yeah, it's a good writer's town.
Absolutely. And what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Oh, well, I've actually, having said that about accessing the imaginative world, I've now gone back to non-fiction, and I'm writing a memoir at the moment about my family and growing up in the 80s and various things that happened to us back then, and it's a lot about my relationship with my sister who died recently. So it's felt like a very important book for me to write. I don't know whether it actually will be a book. I don't know whether it will be published. This one's something that I need to write for me.
And how can we find and follow you, Alice, and buy a copy of Skylark?
Oh, well, Skylark's online, and it's also in Brighton Waterstones, and it's in City Books, and on Instagram, I'm at Alice O'Keefe Books, and that's where I post. I do have a Twitter account, but I don't post on it very much, so Instagram's a good place to find me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Anna. Take care.
Jane McMorrow, the CEO and director of Brighton-based Creative Future, joins us now on the Brighton Book Club. Jane, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Can you tell us about yourself and Creative Future?
I will. Good morning. It's very nice to be here. So Creative Future, it's an arts charity. We're based in central Brighton. We have an office at Community Base. And the organisation was set up in 2007 by two artists, one of whom still works with us, which is great. That's Dominic Delight and Simon Powell. And they, one a visual artist, one a writer. And they both have, in terms of their own work, they both, because of their lived experience, had sort of struggled to find opportunities in terms of the barriers they faced, and set up Creative Future to kind of really explore those where they could find funding to kind of set up projects that might help artists who are in a similar position to them. And it kind of grew from there. And we're now, we're not a core funded organisation, we're project funded, but we're celebrating 15 years this year as an organisation. And we're now, we had, there are five members of the team now, all part-time. So we're still small, but beautifully formed, I like to think. And yeah, doing amazing work both in Brighton and the Southeast region, but also we work nationally.
So as well as the Writers Award, you run loads of great incentives throughout the year. Can you talk a bit about them?
Yeah, so we do lots and lots of work with writers. I mean, what we're here to do is to support underrepresented artists across the board, but we have a real specialism in working with writers. And our Creative Future Writers Award is kind of our flagship programme, really. But we've also, in the last few years, we're doing lots of work within the arts and health sector, which is a real, I don't know how much you know about that, it's a really sort of growing sector in terms of opportunity for artists. We're part of a Brighton-based partnership called the HERA Partnership, and that's working with the Robin Hood Health Foundation. They deliver they work with doctor surgeries, and they deliver an arts-focused social prescribing program across the city. We work with a lot of people with mental health challenges who might be looking for alternative way of dealing with that, and they offer an amazing program of workshops, dance, music, singing, creative coding, photography, visual arts, creative writing. And so it allows people to kind of come together. And that we're seeing a huge success within that sector in terms of an alternative to, we're not saying no medicine, but we're just saying a bit more culture, a bit less medicine, perhaps. So we're doing lots of work in that sector. We're part of that partnership. And we've also, as part of that partnership, we've just launched a training program called Flourish. And that is particularly for freelance or independent artists who may in their own right and with their own practice be very experienced and skilled, but want to develop an opportunity within the arts and health sector. And we're running a 6-month program of workshops and work shadowing and mentoring. It was an application process. We're offering that to 10 local artists. And that started a couple of weeks ago. Very excited about that program. It's a pilot. And then we hope to, once we have that program in place, to be able to offer it more widely. And we'll be running another program of that later in the year. So a real range. We're also doing we're working with a number of partners in the city delivering workshops. We're working with Preston Park Recovery Centre, with Gateway Women's Centre, and also with the Hummingbird Project. And this is a project that I call the Comfy Project, and it's government funding, which is specifically to support communities have been particularly adversely affected by COVID and by lockdown. And we're delivering a range of workshops with those groups, creative coaching, creative writing, but also photography, visual arts. And that leads into us being part of another project, which you might have heard about, which is called Third Thursday, which is being delivered by Video Club and their director, Jamie Wild. And that is, again, some government funding, but to encourage particularly our local communities to engage with the city centre again after lockdown. And it's lots of work in the public realm, projection or installation work that might go into an empty retail unit. So a pop-up performance or for the night. So we're bringing a group of our participants from Preston Park Recovery Centre and from the Hummingbird Project together to work with local artist Tom Buckley. He's a digital artist. I don't know if you've come across his work. He's fantastic. And we're going to create a piece for the third Thursday in April. So that's a very exciting project. Yeah, we're busy.
Oh my gosh, I can't get my head around how busy you are. So Jane, let's talk about the Writers Award. The theme this year is how it started. Can you tell us what someone would need to do to enter the Writers Award and how you choose your themes?
Okay, so it's really straightforward to enter. If you can go along to our website, which is creativefuture.org.uk, and you will find all the information there. I mean, I think literally the homepage, you'll see it pop up there that the competition is open. And if you go in there, it will tell you you all about the things that you need to do to enter. You can, of course, we have an online system for entering, but you can also, there's information there on how you can download an application form if you prefer. And you can also submit your, you can put in your submissions by post here to the community base. There's information about that. And we're open for submissions. You have got until Sunday, the 22nd of May at 11:59 to get your entries submitted. You can submit one piece of writing in one category or one piece of poetry, because it's for fiction writers, but it's also for poets. So you can submit one of each, and that's poetry up to 50 lines and then short fiction up to 2000 words. And the theme, so how it started. So basically my colleague, Matt Friedson, who kind of runs, he sort of manages the Writers Awards, he comes up with a selection of themes, and then we all sort of battle as to which one we like the best. It's not very complicated at all. And this was the one that we thought would be really interesting this year. And you can write to that. I mean, it's just a prompt. It doesn't have to be on that theme, but you know, and it can be quite explicitly about that, or a bit more kind of, you know, yeah, just around the theme. So that's it. All the information's there. So just pop along to our website.
Can we talk about who the judges are this year and some of the previous winners?
Yes. So we have this year, for the second year, the wonderful Dorothy Coombson. And Dorothy is a Brighton-based writer, fiction writer, and she joined us for the first time as our sort of head judge or lead judge. We have one that takes the kind of the major role in terms of the judging process and gets to make the final decisions if there's anything contentious. And she is the kind of best read Black female writer in the UK. You know, she has published so many books, I've lost count, into the 20s now, and is very, very widely read, both in the UK and internationally. And she joined us last year, and she did a fantastic job. She is so incredibly generous, and last year we really wanted to get more Black writers putting in submissions, particularly young Black writers, and she did an amazing job. She's incredibly well connected, and she just did some amazing work in getting us really good people to connect with to say we're doing this and here's the opportunity. And we saw a huge increase in submissions from that category last year, which was fantastic. And then our sort of main sort of judge for poetry is the awesome Joelle Taylor, who started to work with us in 2019 and this year has won the T.S. Eliot Prize, which amazing. Was just huge and incredible. And she is again the most incredible woman, incredibly supportive, has really, really helped us connecting, particularly again with young poets because of all the work that she does herself with young poets. And our other judges are Aki Schultz, who is the director of the Literary Consultancy, and Aki's been working with us for quite a number of years, and we're actually doing a project with her this year, a mentoring project with Literary Consultancy, which is supported by a bursary from the author Claire McGowan, and that's been able to give an opportunity to 10 of our previous winners to further develop their work. Another poet, Sarah Estrich, who's from the Poetry School, and she's been working with us in terms of developing the work that we do with poets. And so our previous winners, well, I'd encourage everyone to come along to our website and buy our anthology, because the other very exciting thing that we do is that we publish an anthology of all the winners. So there are six fiction writers and six poets and a range of prizes. So we start with platinum, gold, silver, bronze, highly commended. And there's some cash prizes, but it's mainly sort of development opportunities. And we have the Literary Consultancy as a partner, and they're offering manuscript assessment as one of the things that we can offer to our winners. We also have Poetry School and the Faber Academy, Curtis Brown Creative, the Society of Authors, Mislexia, the Writing Coach, Waterloo Press. Lots and lots of partners who are offering really fantastic package of support for our winners. Our anthology for last year was called Tomorrow, that's available. No, it wasn't. That was the year before. It was called Essential. Sorry. It was called Essential. That's available on the website, only for a fiver. So it's a fantastic read. And it's also got the work of Dorothy Coombson and Joelle Taylor in there, and Sarala as well. And also the one from the year before is still available, which was called Tomorrow.
Oh, Jane, I mean, you guys do such amazing work in Brighton and Sussex. I'm so impressed. And this is such a great opportunity for underrepresented writers. Before we go, just for anyone listening that isn't quite sure what your definition of underrepresented is, what is that for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's very broad. And I think that, you know, I've mentioned that we do work with a lot of writers with mental health issues. So certainly that's one, but other health issues and also underrepresentation in terms of your identity, also of your social standing, anything that you feel that you as an individual feel is a barrier for you, and that might be around your health, or it might just be around your identity, then we want to help you. And so if you know, we do, because we need for our funding to capture quite a lot of information when you do sort of sign up, we do ask, there's a few boxes to be ticked, but that's mainly so that we can use that information to look at where we're having impact and also identify where we might be able to do a bit better. Like with young Black writers and that approach to Dorothy to join us, to support us in reaching more of those writers, which was very effective. It's very broad. It's one of the few competitions that is open for all forms of underrepresentation. There's a lot out there specifically for certain areas, but we're all inclusive. And what we're really about is kind of making the arts sector more diverse and more representative of this very diverse world that we live in. So that's our ultimate sort of mission and goal, is to kind of really let those important voices to kind of shine through. So we're getting there. It's lots of work still to be done.
So Jane, how can we find and follow Creative Future on Instagram and Twitter?
So on Twitter, we are at creativef_ucha, bit of a complicated one. And Insta is at creativefutureuk.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure, Anna. Thank you so much for inviting me in. Enjoyed talking to you.
Today, I'm joined by Nofel Narwas. Born in the Iraqi city of Basra, Nofel grew up in Brighton and Southend before moving to London. His new novel, Brighton Funk, is set in 1970s Brighton and centres on themes of adolescence, music, and the loss of innocence. Welcome to the show, Nofel.
Thank you, Caitlin. It's a pleasure.
So tell us about the premise of your book.
I wanted to write about the amazing process that happens around the age of about 11, 12, and the following years, the puberty years, when there's a tremendous change in the body through the hormones, and this can produce wild patterns of behavior and affects both the physical and psychological state of the child. I think it's a time that's profoundly etched on all of us, and whether our experiences are what we might deem be good or bad at the time, there's an astonishing change in perspective in these years, a growing realization that one is changing from being an innocent child to joining the adult world, and how difficult this shift is. The second thing I wanted to incorporate was that the things we experience in the form of abuse, or whether physical or psychological, can be overcome and one can be empowered by facing these things, difficulties, and being free of the past, and perhaps even get to a point where one sees that it, because of these things, they've helped one to become who one is. I'm not saying that I'm condoning the perpetrator of abuse or anyone has to suffer to live a good life, but it is part of the human experience that we learn and mature through overcoming difficult ordeals.
And so, tying in with the fact that you grew up in Brighton, what direct memories of growing up in Brighton did you draw upon when writing the novel?
The book is a mixture of sort of some defining moments in my childhood and complete and utter fiction. I wanted to sort of write about something that I felt deeply about, but I didn't want to write a memoir, a story simply about myself. So I used aspects of my childhood experience as starting points to sort of launch into fictional narrative. Actually, what I found was that I really enjoyed the fictional aspects of the book far more than my actual lived experiences.
And so your main character, Nassim, escapes some of his reality by reading. What sort of books had a formative influence on you at that age?
One of the books that I think had a really profound effect on me around the age of 15 was Soledad Brother, The Prisoners of George Jackson. It was my English teacher who introduced me to Jackson's writings. And at the time, the sort of the injustices that Jackson endured that I read about, it filled me with astonishing anger. And the amazing thing I found was his response to them, how he dealt with his incarceration. It really amazed me. He used the time in prison to educate himself. And he wrote a couple of books which were published and actually became bestsellers. In my book, I based the character on one of the characters, on my English teacher, a wonderful man who was always trying to do his best to sort of bring a spark of creativity into our often, well, they were quite dull, boring school days. At that time, also came across the writings of Steinbeck by accident, really. I'd seen the film East of Eden, and which was based on Steinbeck's novel, and it had a deep resonance for me. Well, after that, I just began to swallow one book after another. I couldn't get enough.
I think probably a lot of our listeners can relate to that. As you said, that was what you read when you were 15. Nassim is 15 in the book when we started. How was it writing from that mindset, and what aspects of his character were the most important to you to represent?
Well, I didn't find it hard to sort of reimagine Nassim's mindset. It may be that, you know, those years are deeply imprinted in our minds. I think the psychological changes that occur are so profound that perhaps they stay with us forever. I wanted to write about a flawed character, someone who was abused, but who also became an abuser because of that abuse, and who couldn't cope with the damage because of his age. But I didn't want to create someone who was solely a victim. I guess there's a desire in me personally to avoid the victim mentality and try and promote the possibility of healing, of empowerment, and perhaps actually see that one's experiences can strengthen character. Something that I've sort of found is that if you don't hold on to the past pain and hurt, then it's a way of being free of it.
Absolutely, yeah. And so when you had the first sort of ideas for Brighton Funk, what came to you initially? Was it the characters or Brighton itself or a particular setting or plot that inspired you to sort of start writing?
Well, I think it's one of those things that lives with you under the surface. For a few years, I'd had the idea of writing something, having been inspired by Quadrophenia, along with a few million other people. And I wanted to see if I could write something in a similar vein, but about the 70s as I knew them. There was so much going on in those times that they were amazing. I mean, people look back and think, oh, the 70s were drab. Well, they were, but there was also tremendous fashion going on as well, music, politics, social upheavals. And it was a sort of melting pot of drabness and colour, poverty, wealth. And there was a sense of newness about things. But what I found as I began to write the story was that what really mattered was the relationships between the three main characters, and the 70s were just a backdrop for those sort of questions of love and friendship.
Absolutely. And so you mentioned briefly a little bit earlier, one of your favourite teachers. Nassim in the novel is inspired by his favourite teacher, Mr. Easton. Is he based upon a real teacher that you had?
Yes, he is. And the teachers in my school at that time did their best with a rabble. We were a mob of louts, utterly unmotivated and hormone-infested youth. We weren't academically inclined in the least. Most of the teachers were sort of authoritarians who believed in the old ways of control, proofs, regimented discipline, if you like. But my English teacher was a rare and wonderful exception, and I'm eternally grateful to him. He could be stern, but he also had that wonderful trait of humour, of treating us as intelligent individuals, which was very rare in those days.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, so our listeners can get a taste for Brighton Funk, we'd love for you to read something for us.
Okay, I'd love to, yes. I'm going to read from the beginning, if that's all right. The old man's insane. Hates like a lunatic and looks like one as well. Nothing inside but black stuff. Black tar, bile and vomit. He looks at me, spits in my face, and I stand there. I know what's coming. I know what happens by now. I hold my breath and wait. All this appears on the outside. It's what we see, understand. And mostly we're okay with it, even if it's mad. Then there's the collapse, the reveal. Something happens that's never happened before. It breaks through the surface grime that covers things up. This is one of those moments. I do something. Nothing amazing, barely noticeable. Courage comes when you least expect it. Comes out of nowhere. Leaves a singing in your chest, a sunshine inside, a lightness. But when it's over, it's done, complete. You might smile, you might not. It's not arrogance. I don't know what it is. There must be something inside that's connected to God. Not the church, Tosh. Not that religious crap. Something you can't name. Weird thing is, it's always the same, but always new. A door opens. Some parallel dimension we've forgotten. It sucks you home. You're a star in your own film. There's this thing called out-of-body experience. It sometimes happens when people are dying or in shock. They see things from another place, out of their body. With courage, you're in your body. You don't leave it. It takes over and you vanish. It's no fear. A power snaps in here, doing what you can only dream about. No, I'm in an hurry. No, oh dear, what shall I do? It's too fast. You're in there and it's poetry. Beautiful. You might be taking on more than you can chew, but it doesn't matter. Matter's gone out the window. You're in. When you're done, you're out. No more, no less. Talking of vanishing, me and Johnny went to see Vanishing Point last Sunday afternoon. I let anyone in the Odeon. It smells of maggy dogs and stale piss. Such a tip. Needs decimating, exterminating, vanishing. Most days it's empty apart from dirty old men who come and sit behind you. They start pushing your seat from behind with their knees. One day I had enough. I got up and told the knots to lay off in no uncertain terms. Caused a right old stir. Manager came down and chucked me out. No refund. The perv was still smiling as I left. Vanishing Point was fantastic. fast cars, drugs, and beautiful women. Something else. It was, well, mystical, man. A journey into our times. Cosmic. Beyond the hippie cool and happenings, there was something else. I love those films that make you wonder about stuff. They seem to have a place that lights up inside. The hero wasn't way out, just a geezer caught up in the madness. He pushed it, pushed the boundaries, the surface of things, vanished.
Excellent. Nofel, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on today. Brighton Font is out in paperback on the 24th of March and can be purchased through Hope Road Publishing.
Our book club book this month is Melissa Fu's debut novel, Peach Blossom Spring. A powerful story of resilience, migration, and a family search for a place to call home. It is 1938 in China, and the Japanese are advancing. A young mother, Mei Lin, is forced to flee her burning city with her four-year-old son, Renshu, and embark on an epic journey across China. For comfort, they turn to their most treasured possession, a beautifully illustrated hand scroll. Its ancient fables offer solace and wisdom as they travel through their ravaged country seeking refuge. Years later, Renshu has settled in America as Henry Dao. His daughter is desperate to understand her heritage, but he refuses to talk about his childhood. How can he keep his family safe in this new land when the weight of his history threatens to drag them down? Spanning continents and generations, Peach Blossom Spring is a bold and moving look at the history of modern China, told through the story of one family. This is a gorgeous, sweeping novel, as the blurb describes. It's not a short book, it's quite substantial, but I read it really quickly and felt myself so involved in knowing what happened to these characters that you get really, really close to over the course of the book. It spans three generations, which I absolutely love in a novel. It's so immersive and well-written. You're so invested in what happens, and it's such a good way to learn about Chinese culture and history through the eyes and lives of this family. Much more, for me, compelling than reading kind of classic nonfiction about the subject. I am so excited to be joined by the author of this wonderful book, Melissa Fu. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, thank you. I'm so pleased to be here, Anna.
Tell us about Peach Blossom Spring.
So this is my debut novel, Peach Blossom Spring. And I think it's my first book. I think it was the book I needed to write if I was going to write a book length book. It started a little bit as a short story, but I just knew, and people who read the short story said, no, there's more here. And when I just thought, I'm going to let it be as big as it needed to be, it became this sprawling, huge novel that you've introduced so beautifully.
So you say in a lovely message to the reader at the beginning of the book, it tells the story of a family. It's not your family, but an imagined one, a family created from the stories and anecdotes that you learned while researching Peach Blossom Spring. Can you talk a bit about this research?
So that was a real joy, because I'm not a historian, and I don't know a whole lot of political history. So I just sort of came to this, you know, a little bit later in life and thought, right, I'm just going to learn whatever I can with sort of no preconceptions of what history, how one should study history and how one should make a novel of it. So for me, it was a joy to find these different scholars' research about not only China and Japan during the what we call World War II, or, you know, early on it was called the War of Aggression there, but also through Taiwan and their time in the US. I think, to me, it was so eye-opening, because although that is part of my family's history, you know, as I say, it's a story of a family, partly mine, but mostly put together, these were things I didn't know. And so each time I kind of opened a new box of research, it was like getting another angle on understanding my family's place in history, along with many other families, which had just been a kind of a silence before, like, oh, don't worry about that. That happened in the past. We won't talk about it. So the research was really rewarding, and it involved a lot of trips. A trip to China, and where I tried to retrace my character's footsteps. And at the end of that trip to China, I went to Taiwan, as my characters do, spent some time there. And then over the years in the States, it just happened, as you can tell from my accent, I'm American. It just happened that I was in several of the cities where the story takes place in the States as well. So
what was the reaction of your family? Because it must have really unearthed quite a lot of truths that had been kind of kept, like you said, close to their chest after the war, which is the case with many families.
If I could peer into the future, I would tell you, because they have not read it yet. My dad sadly passed away while I was writing it. So he knew I was writing a book that was based, you know, in a large part about his life, but he hadn't read it. And we'll see what my mom and brothers have to say.
There's this lovely thread, Melissa, through the book about the power of storytelling. With these folklore and fairy tales, are these things that you grew up hearing, or are these things that you learned through your research?
A little bit of both. So there are six stories that I chose to include. There are more that I found. Yeah, I could have made the whole thing all stories. But of those six, a few of them are ones I've just always known. You know, there are some stories you don't remember hearing for the first time, but you just know them. So some of those, some of them are that. The one about the very first one, there's one about the man with a horse. And then others I found as I was researching. And actually the title story, Peach Blossom Spring, was the very last one I found. And I wasn't familiar with that. And I was pretty deeply into writing the novel when I found that poem, actually. And I was sort of taken aback by the parallels I could see between that story and the larger novel I was trying to write.
Please, can you read us some?
Okay, great. So I'm going to read a small section from about the middle of the book. It actually takes place on Lunar New Year Eve, as today we're recording on the Lunar New Year. And the main character is now in Evanston, Illinois. He goes by Henry, and it's freezing cold because it is Lunar New Year. Here we are. On the evening of the Lunar New Year, Henry sits at his desk with a half-finished letter for his ma. For months, he has been trying to find his way around this new language with a frozen tongue. This is his first year in Chicago. He reaches for his Chinese English dictionary. It is as thick and heavy as a brick. The thin pages sound like moth's wings as he flips back and forth, looking for words to understand this kind of cold. When he writes to his ma, the Chinese characters flow like a river down the page, thawing his words. Ma, the winter snows here are fierce and sharp. I don't remember ever seeing snow in Taiwan. The winds are screeching demons that shake the trees. The bare branches scrape my windows in a fury. Some days I wear two pairs of socks and both of my jumpers, and I still feel cold. Today is the eve of the Lunar New Year. I wonder what you are doing. Are you making radish cakes for the Wongs? Sharing a fish and gossiping with Auntie Chin? Do you remember when we lit lanterns and made wishes in the streets of Shanghai? Ma, I miss you.
Oh, it's so lovely and so moving. And the mother-son relationship in this book is so beautiful and tender. I absolutely loved it.
Thank you.
So I'd love to know a bit, Melissa, about your journey to publication, because you've had a kind of career before you started writing, haven't you?
Yeah, so I was in science and then education. I taught for many years. I was a English teacher and then a physics teacher, and then I taught things on my own. But it was, I would say, probably about 6 years ago that I really decided I just want to go for it for writing. I was coming off of a job that didn't work out that well, and I thought, right, what do I really want to do? Because trying to do what I think would be a good idea or what I should do clearly hasn't worked. So I started at that point really taking my writing a bit more seriously. I had written for years and had entered some, you know, small bits of prose and poetry into competitions or submitted them to journals. And I had a few nice acceptances, lots more rejections. That's always the case in the writing. And but then I got, I was really fortunate and got an apprenticeship with an organization called the Word Factory based in London, started by Kathy Galvin and Paul McVeigh. And part of this was I had mentorship with another writer who's called Zoe Gilbert. And that was just a huge, huge step in my writing, in that it gave me a whole much, so much confidence. And then there was somebody who was dedicated to talking about me and my writing. And that wasn't quite the case that things had ever been before. And I think that would be the big turning point. Then there was a lot of writing, a lot more submissions, rejections, so on. But I think that was kind of what started moving towards this. And in fact, it was a short story that I wrote as an apprentice that then became this book.
That's such a lovely story. So your book is out with Wildfire in March. How do you feel about it being exposed to the world?
Oh, a little bit nervous. But also excited. I think I'm just curious to see what will resonate with different readers. We've had a few different advanced readers already, so I've had a taste for that. And it's been interesting because different people will like different characters and identify with them. And I find that really reassuring and also exciting that it's not just a one character book or a one dimensional story to root for. People will say, oh, well, my favorite character was, you know, the mother May Lin, or someone else will come back and say, well, I really liked Lily, or, you know, then I've had a couple questions about the slightly shady character Long Wei, and, you know, more, tell us more about him. So it's exciting because it feels like they have a life beyond me, and that will be neat as they those characters meet their readers.
Absolutely. Melissa, how can we find you, follow you, and get our hands on the copy of this fabulous book?
Ah, great. So I have a website, which is melissafu.com. It's that you can get all sorts of information, news, links, pre-orders or orders from there. I'm also on Twitter at Melissa L. Fu, so there's an L for my middle name, and on Instagram at Melissa Fu Writer. So, and I'm in all those places. Love it if you wanted to say hello.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Here are some news and announcements from Brighton authors and organisations. Our very own Caitlin Gleeson from City Books will be in conversation with MP Jess Phillips on Wednesday the 6th of April at 7 p.m. to celebrate the paperback publication launch of The Life of an MP, Everything You Really Need to Know About Politics. Tickets can be bought at the Rope Tackle Arts Centre website and are £10 or £17 with a copy of the book. Brighton Fringe is teaming up with Gig Buddies for Good Mental Health to find volunteers who can support adults experiencing mild to moderate mental health challenges to attend Brighton Fringe in 2022. Gig Buddies is designed for individuals who are able to live fairly independent lives but need a bit of extra support to attend live events. Brighton Fringe will be offering 2-for-1 tickets so that a volunteer can attend a show alongside a participant for free. To find out more, email info@gigbuddiesmentalhealth.org.uk. Brighton Fringe runs from the 6th of May to the 5th of June this year and currently has tickets to over 350 events now on sale, taking place at venues across the city. Brighton author and Guardian business journalist John Card's new book, How to Make Your Company Famous, is out now and is written to help entrepreneurs get DIY press for their companies post-pandemic. It's definitely worth a read if you are looking to build awareness of your business, especially in the wake of the pandemic. Brighton-based writer Laura Pawley's book, My Asian Summer, is out now. 5 years after the release of her first book, Laura decided to throw caution to the wind, taking her charming and extremely cheeky 5-year-old daughter, Summer Ruby, backpacking around Asia. This tale documents their action-packed and adventurous journey, with every sleeper train, bamboo raft, tuk-tuk, bus and boat ride it took for them to venture across Hong Kong, Thailand, Cambodia and Vietnam. With an unlikely and often testing travel companion on board, Laura offers an entertaining and refreshing travel log that follows the unusual trio on their journey through bustling cities, remote jungles and idyllic islands, living with locals, working as elephant and bear keepers and visiting numerous temples and orphanages. Compassionate, curious and unafraid to reveal her true thoughts and feelings, Laura documents stories of those she met along the way, providing an unexpected and thought-provoking insight into the wonderful and adventurous world of travelling. I recently stumbled across Cordy Bead on Instagram, whose book thongs, not the underwear type, are being sold on Etsy and in the Book Nook in Hove. They are gorgeous bead and charm bookmarks and will make the perfect gift for your book-loving friends. Thank you so much for listening to today's show. Our next book club book is slightly different than our usual selection. It is Toni Morrison's only published short story called Recitative, which has a foreword by Zadie Smith. It was published in 1983 in an anthology called Confirmation, an anthology of African American women, but it has recently been published by Penguin in its own right as a gorgeous standalone hardback with this lovely introduction by Zadie Smith. Here is the blurb to whet your appetite. Twyla and Roberta have known each other since they were 8 years old, when they were thrown together as roommates in a girl's shelter. Inseparable then, they lose touch as they grow older, only to meet again later at a diner, a grocery store, and then at a protest. The two women are seemingly at opposite ends of every problem, but despite their conflict, the deep bond their shared experiences forged between them is undeniable. Recitative keeps Twyla's and Roberta's races ambiguous throughout the story. We know that one is white and one is black, but which is which? And who is right about the race of the women the girls tormented at the orphanage? This story is a masterful exploration of what keeps us together and what keeps us apart, of race and the relationships that shape our lives. Now, with an introduction by Zadie Smith, it is as radically compelling and relevant today as it was when first written nearly 40 years ago. We will be back next month with a historical fiction special including three Brighton writers, Jackie Blose, Fran Quinn and Caroline Brown, all writing wonderful historical novels often set in or around Brighton. Please subscribe to the podcast from wherever you get yours and rate and review us. We will see you in March.